Unsolved Mysteries Rewind is a commercial-free podcast that focuses on cases featured on the television show Unsolved Mysteries with Robert Stack. Each episode features a single case and, if possible, updates and an expansion on the original story. Listener discretion is advised for listeners who are sensitive to true crime details.
Tonight, we have been confronted with an entire catalog of unexplained and unsolved events. Tune in next time as Unsolved Mysteries Rewind discusses another collection of unsolved mysteries. Until then, we can only look and wonder.
My name is Mark, and I am on Lindsay. How are you doing, Lindsay?
I am doing well, as always. Thank you, Mark.
There's a huge truck driving by my house.
I did hear that, but I'll pretend I didn't.
It's like, holy moly. Well, welcome to the week, and welcome to the show.
I've been here before, you know.
You have. We've met here before.
We have. Today, we're old friends.
Today we're talking about a story that goes back to 1986 and Halloween. This is a bit of a focus on darker stories that revolve around Halloween. But you have an update for a previous case that we had discussed about Fred McManus from Valley Stream, the crime spree guy.
Yes. He was a thrill killer of holdup victims in four states, five victims. This was late March of 1953. And oddly enough, you also found recently on a post somewhere that one of his victims, Agnes, her granddaughter, wrote something on there, which I thought that was interesting. He killed in New York, Illinois, Iowa, and Minnesota, and he was sentenced to life in prison in New York in 1953. So we recorded this for episode 5. And what's happened, I'm proud to say, is as time has gone on, I've gotten better at this. Somewhat speaking, but also researching the bejesus out of things. And I do listen to our episodes. And
I don't. And I listen to it enough to edit.
But I know. That's okay. You edit and I listen. But I listen in part to berate myself and also just in part to hear what I need to change.
Okay.
But because you are perfect. But so one of the things that occurred to me is at the end of the Fred McManus episode, we're talking about how we have no idea where anyone went or what happened to them. And I've become a better stalker since we originally recorded this, however many weeks and or months ago. And so I, after I listened to the episode, I went home and I started Googling, and I have a fantastic update for you.
Okay.
So, and I've made Mark wait to tell him on the air. So
I'll be the judge of that.
Yeah, exactly. So Fred Eugene McManus is sentenced to life in prison. He was 17 at the time, as we said.
Going on 40, by the way he looks.
I agree. He's kind of got a, like, James Dean swarthy hanging out in a, you know, pool hall way too long
look. Maybe a 7-Eleven, but yeah, I get it.
No, not even the 7-Eleven, the other one, like the crappy 7-Eleven.
Dairy Queen? I don't know. Oh, In-N-Out, In-N-Out, yeah.
In-N-Out, thank you. That's the one I'm thinking about. So he's sent to Elmira Prison in 1953. He's transferred to Dannemora in 1960. And if you're from New York, you know what Dannemora is famous for.
I don't. You know. What is Dannemora famous for?
Dannemora is where those two guys escaped for. They were having an affair. They were both screwing one of the women that worked there, and she helped them escape. Hamburger patties. It's not in Long Island, but we should probably revisit it sometime. It was a big thing in the last 10 years.
Hey, Lindsay, this is the crimes of Long Island.
Okay, but you should still know.
Maybe.
So anyway.
I read a lot about different crimes. It sounds familiar 10 times over.
So McManus goes to Elmira, transferred to Dannemora in 1960, and then in around 1960s, a New York beach-loving attorney Matt Bradenburg, whose summer is in Atlantic Beach, clearly stolen verbatim from Newsday, takes on McManus's appeal under the objection that they couldn't get a neutral jury because McManus's case was so public. So maybe McManus's confession was not so legal. I mean, I think it was pretty legit, but nonetheless,
he was a minor, you know. I mean, would have only been admissible fully, really, if his father was there, right? Unless he was being tried as an adult.
Remember, we think his father was kind of a D-bag, so.
I'd be a D-bag, too, if I found out my son had done what he did.
Mm-hmm. Right, but it's possible that he did what he did because he was a D-bag.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely this theory that's connected to it.
Authoritarian parenting can sometimes, it's like Romeo and Juliet, just let them date whoever the fuck they want and don't make too much of a hassle because that way they won't end up dead or murdered. So by 1966, McManus has spent most of his time in prison. All his appeals are rejected. He's actually studying psychology, criminal psychology.
Yeah.
And in fact, due to a staff shortage, he is serving as a psychologist in prison.
Why did I do it? Yeah, I mean, maybe that's the question he's trying to answer.
Yeah. McManus is released in 1981, and by 1984, he is cited as a psychologist and professor of criminal psychology several times in several papers over the next some odd years.
Wow.
Where he is giving his opinion on juvenile offenders and whether they can change moving forward, and not a single paper after his release mentions his past.
Wow, so, that is really shocking. I mean, it is shocking, but I can believe it fully.
Yes. He said, in fact, I have a little quote. While there are no guarantees, you seldom have such a horrendous thing done twice, agreed Fred McManus, a Marist College professor of criminal psychology. Many adolescent killings, he said, stem from an antisocial personality, a hereditary psychological profile, usually marked by a horrendous inability to have a close relationship with another person. Other traits include cruelty to animals, truancy, below average performances in school, and setting fire. He could literally be describing himself.
Do you think that he was the Long Island serial killer, possibly?
No.
All right.
Unfortunately, when the antisocial person becomes physically able and the opportunity presents itself, there's a sudden explosion of what has been building up. Even under good conditions, institutions could do little for the antisocial person who generally outgrows the condition by age 30 or 35. But even this type of person is unlikely to kill twice, but rather will return to petty crime. So Manus is telling us what he's up for.
Would he kill four times?
Yeah, exactly. And then again, there's another time years later where there's an investigation, and once again, there's McManus. Police turn to psychologists in search for clues. And this one's much longer, so I'm not going to read it. We could always put a link to it in the show notes. But in the end, McManus dies in 1998, and you were correct. He returned to New York and lived in New Hyde Park.
Did he ever marry?
No.
I wonder if whatever happened with that girl, you know.
I tried to look her up a lot, and I cannot find her. She definitely changed her name. I can't find any evidence of that. But frankly, the reality is, as time goes on, I'll get better, and I'm sure 6 months from now, I'll be like, guess what happened to that mousy-looking girl?
Yeah, that's a really great update. Is he still alive?
No, died in 1998.
Oh, okay. I missed that part.
It's okay. Are you serious? Because I thought it was a really good update.
No, I am serious. I think that that's shocking, actually.
It's also embarrassing to me as a psychologist.
Yeah, completely. I mean, he's also, you know, he studied to do all of this probably mostly in prison, right?
100%.
But his words, when you just said, is there's not much that the institution can do for these people.
Which is why I think it's amazing. Okay, he might be the Long Island serial killer. I'm with you.
Might be. I mean, I guarantee he killed again.
I do, too. Maybe he killed Chaim.
He got away with it.
I know.
So Chaim Weiss, 15-year-old Long Beach. This brings us to And thank you for the update. I mean, I think that genuinely is, I wish we had that information, but this is, no, it's shocking. It's like a shocking end to it.
I'll get better at this gig.
No, it has nothing to do with that. It's you're always going to find more information as soon as you end, you know? And I feel like this is one of those situations. Back in, on Halloween, I'm just going to say it's on Halloween.
I mean, it was on Halloween. It was October 31st, 1986.
And Chaim Weiss was a 15-year-old yeshiva student in Long Beach, New York, the city of Long Beach. It's kind of interesting that we do have Long Beach as a city. I mean, it's a little nothing. It's not a real city. I mean, when we think of cities, we think of, you know, Manhattan.
I don't think it's a little nothing. I mean, it says roughly 33,000 population, and it's like,
I don't know if I'd buy that.
I don't know.
I don't see Long Beach,
it's like the cool place. It's like the place you go when you're young and hip and have too much money and can't afford the city. And then when you live there and you're older, I feel like it's just shady.
Yeah, and I lived in Long Beach. It was like one of the first places I lived when I moved on my own. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's a shady little town, you know. It's and I'll call it a town. There's also a lot of, we will be revisiting Long Beach. There are a lot of really interesting crimes and a lot of really interesting things that happen in Long Beach. I mean, you could pick up Wise Guys, the book Wise Guys, and there's a mention throughout it about Long Beach. You know, Wise Guys is what the movie Goodfellas was based off of.
Yes. And,
you know, Long Beach has... When I lived there, there was a heinous murder about this guy who killed a girl on a beach and I believe raped her and then hid her body underneath the Atlantic, the Island Park Bridge. I don't know if that's the exact name of it.
And, it sounds
familiar,
but yeah, I feel like it's not the only one. I'm guessing
there's a lot to talk about in Long Beach, but this particular story, you know, Betsy grew up next to Long Beach. She grew up in Lido Beach, which...
Okay.
I always tease it's essentially Long Beach, but with higher income levels. and essentially, you know, this is a story she grew up with. And so, yeah, on the morning of November 1st, 1986, right after Halloween, it was Shabbos. It was a Saturday morning. They went to go check on Chaim, and he was late for his morning prayers. And they found that... His dead body was in his room. He was found dead, and he had been smashed in the skull, and it was just a heinous murder. It was one of these type of things where it is so completely crazy that a 15-year-old kid, and no one else is harmed, and nobody else heard anything.
Right. And he was found in... He was staying... So... To flesh it out, Chaim was from Staten Island, but he was staying at a yeshiva, and perhaps we should explain to our non-Jewish listeners, I'm sure there's four, what a yeshiva is.
Yeah, I mean, a yeshiva is essentially, to break it down, a religious school that very often they have dormitories, not always often. I think it's become less popular to have yeshiva dormitories, but this was a particular one where they lived there. He attended, and he would go to his educational instruction through the yeshiva, which is essentially like Catholic school, but Jewish.
Right. But in fact, in yeshivas, and so there's a couple of things. One is, again, he chose to come from Staten Island to Long Beach. And two is they have this like dual curriculum where you're learning both Judaic studies and secular studies. And so I'm always particularly impressed when someone can kick ass coming from a yeshiva, because it's like double the stuff. Because remember, I do interviews for colleges. So
right,
I'm,
double the religious stuff.
No. You have to learn the secular stuff and also the religious stuff.
Right.
And so it's a dual education. And so if you can get like a 4.0 doing twice the 3.7, twice, 1.75 times like the work that the average public school student has to do.
Allegedly. I know several people in my family who attend yeshiva, and I will say that without a doubt, it's about the tuition, which is extremely excessive. And very often I highly question the amount of common sense education that these people possess.
There is a certain degree of brainwashing in all religions, I think, and in just like rote memorization. And it's only later on that they are encouraged to like think through the ethical dilemmas. So I get it, and I agree.
I question anybody who has gone fully yeshiva and university yeshiva, personally. That's just me. I cannot have a normal conversation with that person. I've yet to. I'm related to some of them.
Okay. You know, Mark, you have a very sketch history. You've got mafioso, you've got yeshiva.
Well, like, I don't have mafioso. My father, maybe. But not me.
That counts. So I want, Mark, we should just interview you next time.
I don't do interviews. It's one of the funniest things. I turn down interviews all the time because of my other podcast.
Even with me? You wouldn't do an interview with
me? No, of course not. If you want to learn about me, you listen to my podcast because I talk so much about myself that it's kind of nauseating.
I wouldn't know what that's like. Anyways, on November 1st, 1986, Chaim doesn't show up for his davening, which is the morning religious ceremony, and someone goes to check his room. And not only do they find a dead body, police report that Weiss was hit so hard in the head that his skull is crushed. Moreover, according to the medical examiner's office, one blow was so vicious that it severed the teenager's brain from the spinal cord.
This is crazy to me.
I know a lot about brains and spinal cords, and that to me seems like Texas Chainsaw Massacre shit.
Yeah, I mean, I get this visual that he was partially decapitated.
That is what they are saying, if not completely, yeah.
I mean, everything but maybe the jugular or something. You know, like, it's almost like they had to lift him up, not to be overly visual here, but actually lean him forward and do that. Because if he's laying in bed, how do you do that? I mean, unless he's sleeping on his stomach.
I don't think he was laying in bed for very long, honestly.
I mean, if you're sleeping on your stomach, I mean, then you're an insane person, probably. I don't know who sleeps on their stomach.
I actually have to sleep on my side now because of my back. Although police suspect a hatchet-like instrument, the weapon is never found. He's stabbed repeatedly in the head, neck, and face. Oh, police find a knife on school grounds. A couple days later,
but yeah, I mean,
it's not a fucking hatchet, so it's not going to do the job, yeah.
Yeah, it's a very questionable thing. And sadly enough, that's where the whole thing ends. There's nowhere to, like, if we had to say, well, what happened after that? Well, nothing happened. You know, like, they didn't catch anybody. But I'm not leaving out all the stuff that we have to discuss. I'm simply stating that it's over. They didn't catch the guy. Nobody saw anything. This is before cameras. This is before Ring doorbells. I think that it's a little bit strange. A number of things that come up, you know, after reading into this a little bit. Now, this was also covered on Unsolved Mysteries. Now, I'm going to release this as an additional episode of Unsolved Mysteries Rewind. But did you have an opportunity to watch the Unsolved Mysteries segment?
No, but can I say something real quick? And let's go to an action call. It's not over. If you know something, say something. I did not have the opportunity to, but I read the summary, and then I went to the website on the commentary page, and yep. I looked at that, and so I feel like that's close. I got the Crypt Notes, the Cliff Notes.
Robert Stack is in a shul, which I'm just like, well, what shul? Where's Robert? Why is Robert Stack in there?
Yeah.
And he gives us like a little bit of an overview of Jewish death customs. And they really focus on a few things, right? The mysteries. And somebody had taken Chaim's body from the bed where we assume he was killed and brought it to the floor and opened a window. So this is one of these kind of, how well known is this tradition to you? So I don't deal with dead bodies very often.
Right. I don't either, but I have to tell you it makes sense through the lens of...
It makes sense, but how aware of it were you?
Okay, I'm not, but yeah, me either. I don't often come across dead bodies. You know, fortunately or unfortunately, it would give me a new insight. But so let me just explain, and I think you know what I'm going to say, but for the sake of the listener, most, you know, Judaic customs were... are very practical, even if they sound kind of odd, like not mixing milk and meat. Well, that's a health issue where we didn't exactly have refrigerators.
Right. So. I mean, it's an older tradition because it made a lot more sense then. I mean, being in the modern world, it could be argued that it's not as necessary, but why break tradition?
And all of our customs start as tradition of some sort. And so opening a window after death and moving a body to the floor, which is the coldest point in the room.
Seems logical. Yeah.
It makes sense to me. And so I believe it. You know, also after someone dies, you sort of walk the spirit around the block as a way to walk them home. So opening the window, I can go for that too.
That's well, nice and everything. I just don't think it's a very well-known custom, personally.
But this is just a yeshiva. Everyone there presumably knows these traditions.
Including the murderer. So,
including the murderer.
Yeah. So that is an indication that the person who did this either wants 100%. Us to think, either wants us to think that he no. is. But yeah, I don't, I think that there was, well, we'll talk about what I think, but it's definitely a crazy situation. We know for a fact it's murder, right? This is not a suicide. You don't do this
to
yourself.
Detective Sergeant Willard Crouch says it's definitely murder, mm-hmm. to which I wanted some emojis to be like, no shit. But yeah, it's definitely murder. You can't sever your own spinal cord.
But keeping in mind that when he made this statement, it's a public statement, right? Yeah. It's not like, well, you know, was it a fight? Was it... did it, you know, was it manslaughter? Was it something else? No, it was murder. You know, so
are you going to try to stop me from making fun of people?
I don't know. I didn't know where you were going with the emoji comics. I'm like, because he's got his crazy Kraut last name. I wasn't sure.
No, I was going with like, no shit, it's definitely murder.
But it's a big statement. I'm saying it is a very big statement, especially when it's going to the press. Now, back to Unsolved Mysteries. So, Robert Stack is giving us an overview. They really dwell on the window being opened and this stuff. And they also bring up something that's totally not provable. And that's, they claim a yeshiva student was seen the morning of November 1st on the boardwalk. It's basically because he's wearing a kippah that they think he's a yeshiva student. I mean, it could just be some Orthodox kid, right?
A jogger noticed a student and felt that he was out of place there. This is not surprising. You'll notice a guy wearing a yarmulke. So if you don't want to look out of place, take off the... I mean, I know it's bad, but take off the yarmulke. So.
Yeah. But they don't find the student. They don't even know if he was a student. It's just one of these things, but they dwell on it, and they make it the big mystery at the end. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really care for that too much. I didn't think that was very helpful.
No, you're going to get an eye roll from me. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's like, who is he? Who else saw him? A jogger? Like, I don't trust joggers. So
I don't trust joggers either, and they're all over my neighborhood. And then, like, in the morning, they're separate, and then by the end of their workout, they've conjoined, and they, like, cross the street. It's very scary.
You know that they're not good joggers when they're, like, practically in the middle of the street, and it's like, you know, they're about to pass out.
But there's, like, eight of them. They start with groups of two and three, and then by the end of, like, my route, they've all merged together to form an army, or I like to call it a gang.
Yeah, they're not noticing things. So.
No.
So the bottom line is, we're not really sure what happened. We get a few people who are under investigation. There's a janitor. It's a possibility that he wasn't Jewish. We don't.
The janitor can't be Jewish. He can't be, because he has to like if he has to work Saturdays. He has to turn on and off the lights. The janitors are never Jewish.
Okay. And according to students, Haim had a run-in with the janitor. So
what?
What?
Gonna run in. This kid is described as like super bright, super nice, friends with everyone. He has a run-in with a janitor.
Yeah, because maybe he did something and the janitor is like, what are you doing? Maybe just throwing something on the floor. Who knows?
Okay, fine.
You know,
maybe
Haim was a little douchebag. Maybe he was like treating the janitor like a piece of crap. I know a lot of students in yeshiva and I can totally see that happening. So
yeah, maybe the janitor was the only one who wasn't a Jew and was
right.
an outsider that could be blamed.
I mean, listen, people treat the help in a very, sure. very terrible way very often.
100%.
And I mean, I'm not saying that Haim deserved to be murdered in his bed by anyone, But what I'm saying is it's very possible that he got on the bad side of this guy. But the police cleared him of any suspicion. They gave polygraphs to everybody. Who wants a polygraph? Stand up.
I'll take a fucking polygraph.
Everybody passed. Means nothing. I just roll my eyes. It's like I can't. If you are a polygraph administrator.
How much do you make? What are your qualifications? And can I work part-time and remote? I'll use an 8-ball.
Yeah.
Nines point to yes.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I don't buy into it. I don't believe it. It's not admissible in any legal way. So it's a waste of time. It was a waste of time then. It's a waste of time today. It's worth bringing up to make fun of it.
Yes. I'm going to look for a polygraph admin to interview. I just made that decision.
Yeah. Like find out where you can take the 6-hour class to take it. It's like right up there with massage therapy. So a boy in a nearby dorm claimed that somebody opened and closed his door in the middle of the night.
It's relevant because he's the only other boy. There's only two boys that have a single room and everyone else has a double.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the only other boy. And so he claims that he thought he might have heard it. As Mark pointed out, if this is reliable due to the student's half asleep state and everything else, and if this person was the murderer, this could indicate either that the murderer was an outsider.
Mm-hmm.
I don't buy that worth shit. Or that he wasn't familiar with which room was Hyams. Don't buy it worth shit. There's only two people in single rooms. I also don't buy the idea that he could have been making sure that nobody was awake to potentially witness the crime. Instead, I want to know, why were these two boys in different rooms? Had they been initially put together and separated for some reason?
Mm-hmm.
And if so, why?
So I'm going to play a clip that I meant to play before. This is essentially Zen News 12 talking about the reopening of this case.
Okay.
Here we go.
A father appeals to the public to help find whoever murdered his young son nearly 3 decades ago. We are live at 5 o'clock. Good evening. I'm Stone Grissom.
And I'm Stacey Bell. The 15-year-old was found bludgeoned to death in his yeshiva dormitory in Long Beach back in 1986. Well, today, police reopened the investigation into the teen's unsolved murder.
News 12 Long Island's Eileen LaPalmer joins us now to tell us why, after all these years, that cold case has now been cracked open again. Eileen?
Well, Stone, police say they routinely look into cold cases, but in this case, I'm told that several months ago, homicide detectives got a call from a family member of the murdered teen. They offered to help increase the reward money to $25,000. And today, the boy's father made that public plea for someone to give up a secret they may have been holding for more than 25 years.
It has been over 26 years since our son was murdered.
Anton Weiss read slowly from a prepared statement and paused to stop from crying. He's hoping that someone will give up a secret as to who murdered his 15-year-old son back on Halloween night in 1986.
I'm appealing to you and urging you in the strongest way.
Chaim Weiss, a rabbinical student, was stabbed to death in the third floor of this yeshiva dormitory on Beach Street in Long Beach. The case went cold.
While the case was officially reopened today, police have been looking into this quietly now for several months. In fact, 2 months ago, I sat down with homicide detectives who told me they got a call from a member of the Weiss family offering to increase the reward money.
One theory that detectives are considering a murderer could be someone in the Orthodox community or someone familiar with the yeshiva or Orthodox traditions. Weiss's body was moved to the floor and a window was opened.
There was a window found open. It has to do with the religion. The soul leaving the room.
There were also no signs of anyone breaking into Weiss's dorm room. Detectives say they believe someone knows something but may not have come forward because...
So, yeah.
Wait, I'm putting a notch on my belt for soul leaving the window.
Yeah, no. I mean, there's totally. And also, apparently, the correct way you say Orthodox is Orthodox. So
yes, well, we're in New York.
Well, it's Long Island. It's really a Long Island thing. So... I mean, so they reopen it. Really, nothing happened. Although, looking deeper into all of this, we do...
Yeah, please tell the story of the summer and the phone call and all that.
Yeah, he was... Chaim went to summer camp, and he called, I believe... he called his father. I don't know exactly who
he called. He called his father, and he wanted to come home, and Dad was away.
And he was crying, and he was saying, "I want to come home." It was very not like him to act this way. And they, I guess, convinced him to stay because it's like, you know, it costs $20,000. You got to stay. And, you know, and that's the reality of a lot of summer camp. I mean, yeshiva summer camp, that's another thing. I mean, you're in yeshiva 24/7 when you're in the system. And there are certainly ways that different yeshivas deal with these type of internal issues. And I have to wonder if there was some type of abuse going on, which is why he was crying.
Right, but you haven't really explained the...
So explain.
So he's in... Chaim's in summer camp, and Dad gets a call and that he wants to come home, and Chaim said... Anton asks him to wait a little bit, and...
this part I explained.
And he later seems fine. And then in August, Rabbi Avram Cooper, the school principal, called to ask to meet with Chaim, and later did, in fact, meet with him at his home.
Right. This is all after summer camp.
Right. Chaim didn't reveal what he discussed with Rabbi Cooper, and Rabbi Cooper refused to talk to reporters in the news segment. Anton Weiss, in the same interview, although it didn't make it onto the news segment, said that when he sued the school, which I couldn't find that, but Rabbi Cooper actually told him that the murder happened because of something his family did, which I just think is a shitty thing to say to the father of it.
Well, unless it's, you know, painfully true. It's also the kind of thing where I can imagine them saying it as a guilt thing. Like, you're suing the school. Of course this kind of thing happens to people like you. You know, that type of thing.
Right.
It's a terrible thing to say, regardless.
It's a terrible thing. And we're going back and forth a little bit. But so one thing that you pointed out, Mark, is, and I don't know that this is true, but front door is normally secured by a combination lock at night, but you can't lock or unlock doors on Shabbos.
But then I was just thinking something kind of clean. Well, yeah, you can't use locks on Shabbos. So... you can't turn on a light. You can't turn an oven. You can't, you know, you can't do any of this stuff. Can't use an umbrella. You can't use a stroller. Okay. Well, you're not supposed to use a stroller.
That's not true. You can use a stroller.
Okay. Well, you can't open a stroller. You can, you know what I mean? Like, you can't fold it up and then close. You cannot use things like mechanisms. Look it up.
Okay, so, I will.
But yeah, I mean, things like, mechanisms are just not allowed, including locks. So
interesting. So I know where we should go robbing.
Well, you know, nowadays it's everything's auto locked. So I mean that's totally fine. You know, my house has all because the people who we bought the house from were Orthodox. Everything, all of the lights everywhere have timers on them. Everywhere it's all part. And I don't know how it works, and it just kind of goes on and off on its own cycle because it's based on the moon. So seriously, like, our dining room just kind of clicks on.
You just wait for Betsy to come home and be like, "Betsy, can you turn on a light?"
Honestly, dining room clicks on. We'll watch a movie or whatever, and it'll just kind of click on, and she's like, you know, like, "Oh my God, these freaking Jews."
Mark and I are both Jews, full disclosure. You know, the thing is, what they say is Chaim is, there's another Chaim Goldberg who's a friend of Chaim Weiss's. He lives on the same floor. He described him as one of the best, like, popular and smartest students. He played basketball, chess, and avidly watched the World Series. He wanted to study to be a rabbi. He had earned the nickname Baal Kishron, which means a person who is capable of understanding.
Yeah.
And which is great, that being the case.
How many Chaims do you think they had in the dorm?
More than 64.
Yeah, lots of Amichais and Yoavs and
Avrahams.
Avraham, yeah. Davids, oddly. No Davids.
I bet.
No.
David.
Yeah, it'd be David. With maybe, right. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, although today, Mark and I describe Long Beach as kind of like hip until you get to a certain age and then shady as fuck, but in 1986, Long Beach was pretty run down and shitty.
It was going through its own transition. Now, if anybody knows anything about Long Beach, you did not want to go through there in the early 80s. It was a really, really... there was a lot of terrible stuff. I mean, the roads weren't paved. It's weird because you go through it now and it's like, oh, this is actually a nice like thing. You have little cafes. Yeah, it was all dive bars and.
Okay.
Yeah. But there were always areas that were a little bit nicer. And the Orthodox era was and still is a little bit nicer than the other areas.
Right. Right.
But in general, there's, you know, there's a mix in Long Beach where there still is a very rough area. And that's where a lot of the problems of Long Beach come from.
I have never known a rough area, but I don't. You know,
I'll drive you through there. Oh, you know,
I just go to my yoga studio.
I'll walk you through there.
No, you're taking me on a drive. We've got a lot of sights to see. We've discussed this.
All right, but we can't call places rough. I mean, that's
fine. You know what's bad? Because Hannah Komenoff, formerly the Long Beach supervisor, which is the city's top elected position, says it's a real renaissance. A few years ago, people were ashamed to say they lived here. Now it's becoming chic to have a Long Beach address.
Yeah, Long Beach didn't have anything back then. Keep in mind that I think it was the very first franchise to even enter Long Beach ever, outside of 7-Eleven, was maybe Blockbuster Video. No, I don't. Maybe, you know, when Burger King opened, well, maybe Burger King's been there for a while, but I actually don't think so. I don't think Burger King was there for that long. And it was just a weird town. Like, when they got a Starbucks, it was like, whoa, who got, you know, grease to get put in a Starbucks in? Seriously. I mean, there is a lot of corruption in Long Beach.
Yeah.
And I dislike Long Beach now. I really dislike it.
I go briefly, but, you know. On November 5th, 1986, the yeshiva offers a $25,000 reward, which is $60,000 adjusted for inflation. For information leading to the arrest and conviction of Weiss's killer. And then weird shit happens. And I, Mark, I had to share with you this news day, as always, excellent planning. There are two headlines side by side. And one is Lobster Lab searches for a breed apart.
Yeah, I was like, what's kosher and not kosher about this?
Right. And then on the other side is a militant group unwelcome at Yeshiva murder site. Now, I've never heard of this organization. Have you?
Yeah. They're like the, what's the other one? Like
Guardians? Guardians something?
JDL? Is it the other one? The Jewish Defense League?
I don't know a lot of like brutal Jewish organizations.
Yeah. I mean, this was all a really big thing when I was a kid. Like I think the JDL, I went shooting with them once when I was a kid. Like this was
once again, another weird ass Mark story.
Betsy went shooting with them separately. You know, this is another thing. This was like a big part of Long Island Jewish history when I was growing up in the '80s and nineties, maybe less the '90s, but it was just always around. And when you would go to shul, these people would be there and you kind of meet them and you get a little recruited a little bit. But the JDL is a lot more organized and structured than the JDO or JLO. I forget what it was.
Jewish Defense Organization. And it just sounds weird.
Now, they're also, I believe the Jewish Defense Organization was caught up in a lot of corruption. I think there was like a shady guy running. I think there was a lot of really underhanded, weird stuff going on. So it doesn't surprise me that they were like, look, we trust the police. The worst, you know, the police will nowadays just pull you over for going 31 to 30. But,
well, first of all, I mean, the JDO shows up. They try to mount an armed patrol around the Long Beach neighborhood where Chaim was killed.
Like in Cedarhurst.
What?
You know, in Cedarhurst, we have those roving patrols.
Right. At 9 p.m., 18 men pull up in several cars across the street from the school, along with two Doberman pinchers and a German shepherd. They should have had more dogs, but whatever. Yeah. We're out here because we give a damn. We're going to make sure nothing happens. And then one of the men opens the trunk of the car, and one by one, they pull out four shotguns, an Uzi semi-automatic rifle, and an M16 semi-automatic. I know nothing about guns, but I know that as a teenage boy or girl, I would have been shitting my pants inside watching this.
Yeah, and these are not 22 rifles. These aren't the 22 caliber hunting rifles or anything like that. Although the Uzi could be a 22. That's one of those things. But
they're semi-automatic. That sounds serious. Semi-serious.
All guns are semi-automatic.
Oh.
know, that's why it's semi. You just, as fast as your finger goes, you know. Fully automatic is a separate, a whole different thing. These were not that. These aren't the, these are more like.
So, yeah, I can't wait till we get to the episode where I explain football for you, to you, since you've explained so many guns to me.
Yikes. We will get to it. I do want to mention, I do have my theory about the lock. I do want to just throw this in. I forgot to mention this.
Yeah.
That, all right, so with my family who are Orthodox, they have hired help, of course. And during Shabbos, the help can do whatever the hell they want. Right, so you can go turn on that oven. You can turn on that switch. So it's very possible that the janitor, possibly being a non-Jew, would open and close the lock. Also, the janitor would have full access to open and close the lock.
Right, and I've also been at shul, or my mom's been at shul when she was a child before she converted to something Christianity. This is another story, but when like the power goes off and you've got to get a non-Jew to flip the switchy thingy.
Yeah.
So you're right. It does leave a possible opportunity for a janitor or another non-Jew. Although I have to think, if you're going to kill someone, you might make an exception for a Shabbos rule.
That's definitely possible. Except you still are open the window and everything. It just seems so crazy to me. Now, the other theory that kind of is being thrown around is that this was a hit.
I think that's just garbage. I mean, come on. Are you really? No.
Yes. No. There's no evidence of it being a hit, except the crime kind of looks like a hit. So it's weird because you look at it and you're like, well, if you had just thrown in that this guy owed somebody like 10 grand and didn't pay it, it would be believable all of a sudden. So,
well, or if there was another idea that that it was a hit, but they had chosen the wrong single dwelling room. That was poorly worded, but you know what I mean. Like, they didn't mean to get Chaim; they meant to get the other guy who didn't have a roommate. If we had his name, I could stalk him, but we don't. But I don't buy this hit shit. It's just that it's like the 80s, and if we can't solve something, it's just like in the 90s. If we can't solve something, it's the Long Island serial killer.
Yeah, it is true. It's a real sad thing. Anton Weiss, I think he's still around. He's still mourning his son, of course. And he seems pretty passionate about it. You know, he's...
Yeah. And there's two little kids. There was a 7-year-old daughter and a 11 or 12-year-old younger brother.
They still are, I'm assuming that they...
Yes, I know.
Now, his older brother's name is Michael.
Yeah.
I never met a Jew named Michael, I don't think.
Are you joking?
Oh, no, yes, I have. What am I talking about? All right. I'm just being facetious. So, I'm thinking of, like, a lot of Italian people I know named Michael.
Okay. Well, my very Jewish husband has a brother named Chris.
Is he Christian?
Well, let's just say the desire of the family to all marry Jews did not work so well.
You should spell it K-R-I-S. Just make everyone mad.
Except for Chris Christopherson, who would be totally flattered.
Yeah, I don't know who that is. But I know the name, but I don't know who he is.
It doesn't matter.
Is he Jewish?
I don't think so. So Chaim appears to have died instantly. The school tightens security in December 12th. 1986, Chaim's yeshiva reaches out to 592 Jewish schools, asking them to take advantage of free security surveys given by police to assess security. Okay, now we get to a fun part. December 26, 1986, Detective Sean Spillane, who we know from the Jacqueline Martorella case that went nowhere, and several other cases, gets shifted out of his job because the DA is, as Lindsay likes to say, sort of like, we thought you'd be a better fit somewhere else, which I interpreted to be, why can't you solve a fucking murder? Because there's a lot of them that he can't solve. An anonymous source, and obviously it's not all his fault, an anonymous source says he just wasn't as interested in the DA's perspective as we would have liked. The source goes on to say that the transfer has absolutely nothing to do with the unsolved case of Chaim Weiss, businessman Samuel Quenzel, who was shot to death in the driveway of his Woodmere home, sniper victim Anthony Sarantino, the Freeport barber who was killed on the Sunrise Highway in Merrick, or anyone else.
We should really thank them for giving us names to look up.
Mark, 100%. In my head, I'm like, Google Samuel.
Sammy Quinsel. I want to know all about that.
You know I'm going to get to it by the end of the day.
And you know, another thing is, like, these are probably all unsolved. So even better.
Well,
not
of
better.
Of course they're unsolved because this detective didn't, I don't know. I like blaming
people. I do have a weird question about this. So, all right, so Long Beach, the city of Long Beach has their own police force.
Yes.
Now, we're talking about Nassau County coming in.
Yes.
Now.
Oh, I have the answer.
No, yeah, is it because of homicide? I don't know.
Yes, Detective Sean Spillane was the head of the homicide department.
Huh. I wonder if Long Beach has their own homicide department now because of so many deaths there.
It's an excellent question. I don't know the answer.
Mm. They don't really have that many deaths, but it's definitely one of these kind of hotbeds for strange things. And I think beaches in general, beach communities.
Yeah, I feel like they just have a lot of drunk teenagers and
you go to West Ed? Let's go to West Ed.
Yeah, and St. Paddy's Day, and yeah.
There's nothing like seeing a 13-year-old girl vomiting into a sewer. At it's 9 really, in the morning.
It's super sexy.
Yeah. That's my Long Beach. That's the Long Beach I remember, and it's one of the number one reasons why I left.
It hasn't changed, Mark. It hasn't changed.
I used to live on West Olive, and during the summer, it was just crazy in a sense. I mean, I was a few blocks from the beach, and in the summer, you just couldn't even get your own parking spot. It's just insane, the tourism. And you just learn to hate tourists.
Well, I grew up in Florida, so same.
Yeah.
Are you comfortable sharing your theory?
Well, I think my theory is pretty much simple. It's essentially, I believe that one of the students did this. And I'm not 100% sure. I don't have a motive. But the only people who would have had access were the other students. I just don't know who would have been able to do it. So my theory is really weak. It's not even much of a theory. It's just, I think that it was an inside job, so to speak.
That's all you're giving us? Okay.
Maybe I'll throw in more. I don't know. I haven't really thought about actually the outcome because there's so much weirdness about everything.
Right, but you also found a note that a few years after the crime, Haim's family got an Easter card. That's the first weird part.
Yeah.
Addressed to him, which said, "Know what happens to chickens when they get too old to lay Easter eggs? They die."
Yeah. This was probably post Unsolved Mysteries, right? So there's a very good chance that this was a fake thing. And this has happened in other cases as well that I've read about. People are sick and people want to just kind of mess with the family and they'll just do something. I don't personally see a Jewish person sending an Easter card.
Especially not an Orthodox person. You're going to go to the store and buy an Easter card? I mean, someone's not going to remember that?
Yeah, I don't know. It just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And I just think it's just too cruel versus the crime. I mean, the crime is cruel, but it's not like they beheaded him and put it on something and did something that...
No, but I think beheaded falls into the cruel category.
Well, you know, it's not like they it was almost like they respected the body after killing it. They were right. There was some level of respect given, which is a weird thing to say about murdering somebody. But there was also, I just want to also mention that there was no evidence of any type of sexual assault. You know, that's another thing that I'd read.
So, wait, but what you're saying actually to me speaks to maybe there was a killer and then someone who was remorseful that perhaps they could have prevented the... Like, two different people and one...
Oh, you think two different people did this?
I think one person murdered and one person knew. And that's the person who tried to...
Do you think it's a cover-up?
I sort of do. I mean, I have a more complicated theory, which I'm comfortable sharing. I mean, so apparently a few years before Haim Weiss was killed, there was a boy who hung himself in the shower. I can't find it in the news, but that's not surprising.
Yeah, I read it too. So it happened. We just can't seem to find any verification.
Right. Suicide is a rather huge no-no in most religions.
Yeah.
So my thoughts, from a shrink perspective, begin to circle around the idea of an abuse or / homosexual relationship between this first John Doe and either an older boy at the yeshiva or a younger teacher. Perhaps Chaim found out about the abuse and threatened to unearth the secret, although that doesn't seem like Chaim unless he was looking out in the best interest of another boy. But I can imagine either the victim or the perpetrator, and the psychologist in me points to the victim, being super angry and looking to express his anger at someone smaller than he is because of the embarrassment that would come out if it was revealed that he had been, although sexually abused.
It's not even embarrassment. It's
right.
For the yeshiva, yeah, I mean, it's the worst, yeah.
Right. And then I could see that being a motivation for violently attacking Chaim in order to keep his secret.
Could Chaim run, kind of walked in at the wrong moment and saw something? And
yeah,
then,
at a different point in time, I think, yes. Yeah, and I would be that. And my other thought is that I believe, and this is my gut, that that individual stayed at the yeshiva for quite some time, probably because he was protected or was comfortable, and it had come to seem like a safe place, and leaving would be like a red flag. I mean, my mind went back to the, Jerry Sandusky of Penn State, who for years, was sexually abusing kids and protected by his football record.
Yeah.
Rabbi Pitter's wife, Rena, tells Pix11, in our family, we did think maybe it was one of the janitors, and I call bullshit for all the reasons that we've discussed, because we've already discussed, like, the Judaic customs.
Yeah. He would have also, in all fairness, devil's advocate here a little, the janitor very well might have understood about this custom.
That's true. That's true. The Long Beach Yeshiva is still there in the same place. And then instead of watching the Unsolved Mysteries like you asked me to, I went to the threads and got caught in a rabbit hole, especially because this one's from June 23rd, 2021. And someone named Abraham, who I need to talk to immediately, said, I remember the case. I've always been intrigued by it. I was in a parallel yeshiva and heard talk about this case. Then he says, point number one, I have no idea who did this crime. That's a weird point to start with.
Yeah.
Point number two, in 1994, I was in Israel and I was learning in yeshiva. I dormed with this kid who was a good few years older than me, tall, and was originally from the U.S., and who had a violent temper and couldn't sleep unless it was completely dark. I don't know why, but at the time I thought he killed Chaim. Something about this guy. I once went near his closet and saw he had a 24-hour candle in his closet, the one that they light for the dead. Okay, so I don't know who did it. This guy did it. Number three, it may have been connected to molestation. Of course, I don't know. To quote Shakespeare, methinks the lady does protect too much, and or this guy thinks he's being interrogated on an unsolved mysteries thread. Then he goes into this shtick about, the mob, essentially. I don't know. And then he says, I think all the talk about Jewish traditions of this case is garbage and not connected to the case. The window open, the body on the floor has nothing to do with religion, possibly to do with the murderer wanting to hide the body. Or he thinks maybe he was opening the window to throw the body out the window. No.
What's wrong with this guy? I don't want to talk to him.
I want the police to talk to him.
Oh, right.
And then he says, people who murder don't all of a sudden become experts in Jewish traditions. Right, but Jewish people who murder are already experts in, and then I got,
This sounds like it's translated from Hebrew. So
I don't think it's translated from Hebrew. I think this guy knows a lot more than he's saying.
But his points are completely weak, I think.
Everything, I know. I think this guy is creating some sort of an alibi for him or whatever. And he goes on and on. The students didn't know who did it. They truly don't. A rabbi who was molesting him would never have killed him in the dorm on a Friday night. Just never. Makes no sense. And I would give this one to him, except that if a rabbi is going to molest a kid, he's already sort of taking Judaism kind of light and loose. He then gives two other totally unlikely scenarios and then said, nobody knew the murderer who was because he wasn't actually any of the actual students, but was familiar with the school. So I really need the police to look into this guy.
Now, one of the news things that I located actually spoke to one of the previous students. Now, okay. I don't know if you had the opportunity to watch that, but he's. I'm gonna dig it up. Oops.
Who found him?
Well, I'm just gonna find this guy talking. Basically, this is like a little segment where they're just kind of over discussing the whole case, and they confront the rabbi. But I'm just gonna play some of it. But in this is one of the students that actually was in the dormitory with Chaim that night.
In July 1986.
He called me up crying in a very strong way that he wants to come home.
Weiss said his son later seemed fine, so he sent him to Europe to see his grandparents. Weiss claims the school's principal, Rabbi Avram Cooper, called him twice in August 1986.
This is when he's coming home. I said a week or two. Then he called me again.
It's something we tried to ask Rabbi Cooper about in Lakewood, New Jersey, where he's now retired.
His father has been looking for answers.
This guy is like your typical, I don't want to talk to you type of thing. And it's just, I can't say I totally blame him. This woman's really getting in his face. He's just basically saying, no comment, I don't have any answers about it. And it could be legitimate.
Right. I mean,
this guy, I'm sorry, go.
No.
This guy is one of the students, previous students.
Fished for bad deeds.
We think I stole something, I did something, I killed somebody.
But this wasn't no Halloween prank. This was somebody trying to get back at the family, I'm assuming, or trying to get back at the kid.
Former student Ellie Kushner, who now works as a truck driver, said Chaim Weiss was assigned his own dorm room on the third floor while almost everyone else bunked with other kids.
They must have knew exactly where this kid was because you had to go through a lot of different rooms to find him. And you had to pass by a lot of kids to get to this kid.
There was no back way into Chaim's room?
No. One way in, one way out.
Rabbi Yerachem Pitter.
So I thought that was kind of interesting.
That's the dumbest question ever, though. Why would anyone have a back way into your dorm room? I mean, whatever.
Well, I mean, I think they're just saying, were there other exits and entrance ways? Like, a house. You know, it's like most houses have several ways in and out.
There's a window. It's a dorm, you know.
But, you know, it really does look like this place really. I mean, we don't know what the back of it looks like, if there's a back door, but that would be another way in.
There's no back door in a dorm.
It would have to be. Legally, you would have to have an exit.
In the dorm, but not in the dorm room.
Oh, no, not in the dorm room, but to the hallway that leads to it, I think. You know, like, so if you can enter the entire dorm from the rear of the building, I think that's what the question was about.
Gotcha. That makes sense. I found something else on that Unsolved Mysteries, and this really struck me. Much like when we spoke about Cheryl Pearson, and I was like, I believe 100%. She sounds like a legit victim.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt this way about this. Because I have worked with sexual abuse survivors, and this just spoke to me. I attended the school 3 years later. While there, I heard from older students about what would have been viewed in the Orthodox world as a problem of homosexual liaisons between certain students. I heard further rumors that the victim, Chaim, had been involved in it. Years later, when I was in yeshiva in Israel, which, by the way, I'm not supporting that as truth. That's clearly a rumor.
Yeah.
Years later, when I was in yeshiva in Israel, there was a divorced fellow attending the same yeshiva who had left the Long Beach yeshiva before I attended. One night, he invited me to his parents' vacation apartment near downtown Jerusalem, with the offer of a normal American bed for the night. He shared that he had been good friends with Chaim, which is odd given the age difference. He told me he had been divorced because his wife accused him of sexual deviance. He had adamantly denied such accusations and even refused to divorce her for a long period. He had the support of top rabbis, and his father was a known, successful, and influential businessman in the Orthodox world. Later that night, at his apartment, he sexually assaulted me. I told him that if he did not speak to his mentor at the yeshiva within 3 days about this behavior, then I would. He acted like he had no idea what I was talking about, so I realized I would get nowhere with his word against mine. A few years later, when we were newlyweds, my wife and I met this person when we were leaving a store in upstate New York. This person asked me why I did not invite him to my wedding. I told him he knows why, but if he insists, I will tell him in front of my wife.
So he lives in Muncie, yeah. Is what he's saying.
Fast forward about 19 years, and I saw him at a wedding in the same town. I got the hell out of there. I nearly vomited. In my mind, a character like this guy could easily have killed Chaim in a crime of passion, yet pathologically compartmentalize it to the point that he referred to him as his friend. He did the same with me. Now, to be clear, I'm not saying I do believe that this man was sexually assaulted by this other man. I'm not saying that I do believe that this one man was a predator. It is possible that he preyed upon Chaim. Obviously not the writer, I'm talking about the identified predator.
Yeah, yes, yes.
But I'm not saying that there was a problem of homosexual liaisons between certain students. I wouldn't go that far. It's just that this very much sounds like someone who is capable of both rape and possibly murder, you know? So this really struck me and was really...
But again, you know, the thing is no names, right? There's no calling anybody. If you really feel this passionate about somebody,
I agree.
Call them out.
Someone wrote that in the net. Like the next person who responded to this was like, if this is true, you should call the police.
Yeah, you should. I mean, I think that it's the greatest violation is sexual assault. And regardless of how much time has gone by, people really need to deal with this now. Like, you know, I don't care if it was 30 years ago. You need to deal with it now. And it really upsets me when people just don't. You know, they're just like, yeah, it's 30 years ago.
Well, I agree. I think it's upsetting. It's someone's child. You know, it's someone's brother. It's someone's sister.
The murder of somebody's child that this might, you know, be a part of.
And clearly, let's say this man, sexual predators repeat themselves. It's not a one-shot deal.
Right. Kind of like McManus. Is that his name?
Right.
I believe that he probably killed again. He got away with it. He did the perfect murder, you know, in a way. He did his time. He got away, and he perfected it. He became a student of the method and then became a teacher of the method.
100%. And by the way, every name that we came across in every article, I looked up to see if anyone had any records.
Oh, really?
Yeah, just speeding. And once I found one of these was like 68-year-old man who got arrested for like possession of like drug paraphernalia or something. I was like, let the man smoke his dope. He's not our guy. Like,
yeah, it's a crazy story, but like I said right in the beginning, nothing.
No, and if you know something, do something.
Yeah, I mean, I will say though, the little sandbox that the yeshiva institutions have created protect people. It's like the Vatican in some ways. It's what, you know, they deal with it internally.
I know, but I'm guessing that there was, I mean, I agree. I think there was a financial thing here where it was, don't piss off this guy's, you know, very wealthy father.
Yeah. Well, Lindsay, we've come to the end. Unfortunately, there's no other bits of information to share about this. It's still a cold case.
I know. I hate cold cases, but then again, I want to.
The only thing that this really added to the entire world of Long Island is another Halloween story, another scary story to talk about.
And, we got a lot more.
Yeah, we have tons of them. But thank you, Lindsay. Thank you for all the work that you put into the show, and I look forward to the next one.
Tonight, we have been confronted with an entire catalog of unexplained and unsolved events. Tune in next time as Unsolved Mysteries Rewind discusses another collection of unsolved mysteries. Until then, we can only look and wonder.